episode 15 of FemWonk. I'm your host, Katie Davey. Today we talk about the rise of minority governments in Canada. I'm joined by Jordan O'Brien, who was at the forefront of the negotiation during the recent minority government situation in New Brunswick. We'll ask him about his experience there, as well as his opinion on the minority governments popping up across Canada. He's also a bit of a history buff, so we get a bit of a lesson on what the minority landscape has looked like in the past in Canada, and again, some predictions on what it will look like in the future. Apologize that this episode is a little bit late, but luckily I had the opportunity to be at GovMaker, which is an open government conference hosted in New Brunswick every year over the past few days, and it was really such a great experience. I'm so reinvigorated, and I actually can't wait to chat with you more about that, so stay tuned for some blog posts and hopefully a podcast that highlights what we learned there. Without further ado, let's get into the episode. Jordan, thanks so much for joining FemWonk today. We're happy to have you back, and I hope we get into just as many detailed conversations as we did the first time you joined in episode 3 to talk about some more kind of wonky policy. I think today will be just the same.
If you're looking for a nerd, you found him.
No, we like to call them wonks. That's the point of the title, right? Not nerds. So I think today it's a unique opportunity to dive in a bit into some political history in Canada, into some New Brunswick politics, and then more broadly, kind of current politics in Canada. There's some interesting things going on, so I thought you'd be a great person to chat with about that, and a great person to give our listeners a bit of, like I said, a history and kind of what we can look forward to as some of these new governments in Canada roll out. So, Jordan, the first thing I want to talk about is the fact that really Canadian political history has kind of taught us that governments win re-election when the economy or other key indicators are doing well. However, in the last number of provincial elections, we've kind of seen that that's not really the case anymore, and particularly just here a week ago in PEI, all things kind of looked like they were going ahead, and then the government got reduced to the third party. Very similar thing happened again in Ontario, and I think that that's just like a bit of an interesting context when that's not necessarily what folks would maybe have pegged beforehand. So I'd love to know your opinion on why that might be the case, and I guess maybe any insight you have on what we might be able to expect to be things that will be indicators in the future.
It's kind of hard sometimes to tie all these things together without the benefit of a lot of hindsight and see what was really the underlying trend. But the other election I might throw into that bundle is Alberta. And two of them are very similar, and the other two are very similar, but they're quite dissimilar from each other, but they had the same outcome. So that leads me to wonder whether there's something else going on that maybe we might not fully appreciate yet and need the benefit of some water under the bridge. But PEI and Ontario were, of course, both governments that had been in office for 3 or 4 terms. In both cases, I mean, in the economy in PEI and Ontario probably were among the two best economies in the country when those governments changed, which is quite atypical, but they were old, tired governments, so maybe that's the explanation. Alberta and New Brunswick, the economies were relatively good, perhaps not quite as on fire as Ontario and PEI, but they were both one-term governments. And I guess what the four of them have in common is they're all particularly progressive. So I don't know how to solve for all of that other than to say I do think that it's becoming more and more apparent that social media is really changing politics in a number of different ways. We see the rise of these populist movements, which we didn't really see in PEI, although you might describe the Greens as a left-of-center populist movement, but certainly in Alberta and Ontario, we saw the Progressive Conservative parties more or less taken over is maybe too strong of a word, but elect very atypically right of center leaders. In Alberta's case, they actually merged with a party that was further to the right in the process. In New Brunswick, we saw the combination of the People's Alliance, a right of center populist party, win some seats and come third in the popular vote with a significant amount of votes. And then the PC party leader was also, you know, a bit more right of what we've typically seen for PC leaders in New Brunswick. So is there some kind of a populist uprising that's to explain this? Maybe. It's harder and harder for a government to get reelected in an era when people are looking for instant gratification in everything in their lives, and 4 years is not really a lot of time to make fundamental change in something as slow moving as a government, and people just get fed up. 4 years, what are you doing for me? And they try somebody else. Eventually that's going to become unsustainable because they'll change through each party a couple of times, and which we've sort of seen in New Brunswick with this back and forth now since 99. It's been almost a change of government every time. The Tories were barely reelected in 2003 and nobody's been reelected since. So is it just an impatience issue? I don't know. I don't think we can really figure that out until we can look at it back 20 years from now and see what all of the things were in play and what were the outliers and what was actually indicative of some kind of trend.
Yeah, I think you raise a good point about social media. It's something I've been thinking a little bit about more these days because folks, you know, as we gear up towards the federal election, more and more folks who maybe don't talk about politics in between elections are starting to get engaged. And what I've kind of noticed is folks that maybe I knew that were very like strong on the Justin Trudeau train three and a half years ago are now even maybe strong on the Scheer train, which is such a, like, they're just two obviously very different parties, very different people. But what I've also noticed is those tend to be folks who are very soft kind of voters, meaning, as you know, not necessarily a partisan, don't necessarily vote with the same party every time. But they're also folks who consume almost all of their news from social media, from Facebook, and not kind of, you know, reputable CBC sites on Facebook, but the really like shared posts, things like that. So I've been thinking a little bit about that and how that kind of, as you mentioned, plays into the movement building almost. Like those folks are maybe a bit more motivated to jump on a train. That's something I've been thinking a little bit about. I don't know if you've experienced a similar thing.
Yeah, no, I know lots of people that are planning to vote conservative this fall that voted liberal last time. Now, that's not necessarily a new phenomenon. If you look at a 1980 majority government under Pierre Trudeau, followed by a 1984 largest majority government ever under Brian Mulroney, obviously a lot of people switch from liberal to conservative in that cycle as well. And probably, again, when you go from 88, a majority conservative government, to 93, a majority liberal government, there is a group of centrist people, probably to some extent, but also low information voters that are maybe voting more on personalities or a few big issues that are in the window that don't see that as too crazy of a change to make.
I think the correlation between social media is interesting and you know, one that I'm sure folks will continue to try to make for many years to come. But yeah, back to chatting about what governments are looking like across the country right now. After PEI, there are now three minority governments, and I know you'll maybe call me on the use of the word minority, but basically no party having the majority of the seats that will be governing. And this is a kind of a unique position to be in with three across the country. I'd be interested to know your thoughts on what that means for, you know, politics more broadly in the country, or even what that looks like in those provinces. And again, you having some more kind of political history insight, is this as unique as maybe we think it is in Canadian history?
Well, my gut reaction is that it's not that unique, but I went back and did my research in preparation for this podcast, and it is a little bit more unique than maybe I would have given it credit for. I don't think that there's ever been three provincial minority governments at the same time, unless I missed something when I was doing my research. Certainly, they're not uncommon, but it really depends from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So federally, they're relatively common. Six of nine elections from 57 to 79 were minority governments, and more recently we had three back-to-back minorities at the beginning of this century. But at the provincial level, it's kind of interesting. There's a fairly robust history of minority governments in BC, Manitoba, and Ontario, which is not coincidentally some of the provinces where we've had a much longer running and stronger third-party presence. In Quebec, for instance, we've had two minority governments the last 15 years, but those are the only minority governments that they've ever had in Quebec. It does vary, and here in New Brunswick, I mean, depending on how you define a minority government, we have our first one ever. I would probably argue in 1920, the governing party was one seat short of a majority, but it was at a time when parties were a lot more fluid than they were, and you could govern quite easily as a majority in that kind of a context, and that's how they governed. So yeah, so it certainly is more than usual at one time, and I think it's reasonable to say that there's a pretty good chance we're going to end up with a federal minority government by the end of the year.
You mentioned, again, in New Brunswick, this really being the first kind of technical minority government. They're, again, facing the same thing in PEI. Of course, and for those listening that aren't aware, Jordan, you were at the forefront of that historical election on September 24th in New Brunswick and the kind of six-ish weeks following and what that unfolded and looked like. I'd be interested to know your experience with that. And again, without having a model in New Brunswick per se, where you maybe were looking for precedent across the country and even broader than that on how to move forward in, again, a situation that was historic.
Well, before I answer that, I don't sell yourself short. You were also at the forefront of that. Yeah, I mean, it's very unique for New Brunswick, but also the outcome was quite unique. You had two big parties with almost a tie in seats and two smaller parties with a tie in seats, and really hard to imagine one of those small parties, i.e. the Greens, doing a deal with the Conservatives. Very hard to imagine the People's Alliance doing a deal with the Liberals. So you had almost a European style kind of pre-baked two coalitions on either side. Notionally, certainly there was no, on the left side of the equation, there was nothing formal before, during, or after. And I don't think there was anything formal on the right side of the equation before either. But there was just a natural alignment there of two blocks. It's not where you've seen quite often in minority situations across Canada where there's three parties involved, not four, and one of them, the smaller of the two, really could arguably go either way, and we weren't in that kind of a situation here. So it also resulted in the need, particularly on the Liberals' part, because we were not in the poll position, having come second in the number of seats, that you needed to have a formal deal to make it work. You couldn't do it informally, which has been the tradition in Canada, is the coalition agreement or even a confidence and supply agreement has been the case in a small fraction of the minority governments we've seen in this country. The much more normal, quote-unquote, outcome is what we're seeing in PEI, where one party has a significant plurality of seats and everybody else just kind of puts the swords down and says, congratulations, you won. It's a little different when the seat numbers are much closer, like in New Brunswick last year. Probably the best-known example is in Ontario in 1985 when the Conservatives won four more seats than the Liberals, but the NDP had 25 and sided with the Liberals, and thus there was a confidence and supply agreement put together to have a Liberal minority government there from 85 to 87.
What is interesting, too, in the New Brunswick context was that although the governing Liberal Party did not win the most seats, it did win the popular vote, which again, when you compare to PEI, it's much more clear cut. The party with the most seats won the popular vote as well. However, in PEI, and I would be interested, because there hasn't really been a ton of information that has come out since the election to see kind of how they'll move forward, that I've been aware of. But although the PCs got 12 seats, the Liberals and the Green equal 14. So be interested to know your thoughts on, again, what that path forward looks like there. And again, like you mentioned, it isn't really the same as New Brunswick, but what your opinion would be based on some of that experience.
Yeah, I think they're just totally different. So there's one more seat to go in PEI as well. There was a tragic death right before the election that is prompting a by-election in one seat. So if the government were to win that, then there are 13 seats, 14 being a majority, and then they just need to find some opposition member to agree to be speaker, and they can almost govern as though if they have a majority. A few assumptions down the road between here and there. But, I mean, four seats doesn't sound like a lot, but in PEI, the PCs have 12 seats, the Greens have 8. That's 50% more seats than the Greens. So it's just they're so far ahead. It's just different. And so you've seen that in a lot of situations federally and provincially where there's minority governments, and if the biggest party has a large plurality, people just kind of accept that result. And even sometimes when it's not that large, in 57, I think, with Stephen Baker, when he first went in, he only had 7 more seats than the Liberals out of 265, and there were like 50 people from other parties. So the Liberals could easily have strung together a deal, I would think, to hold on, but didn't. Now, there were a lot of other factors. They'd been in government for 22 years, and the Prime Minister was 75 years old, which is a lot older in 1957 than it is today. And I've read about how there was quite a lot of pressure from the Liberal caucus for him to try. And he said, look, I'm old and I'm tired. I'm going home seeing my grandkids. And that's the other thing that a lot of people don't understand. It's not party that has the right to form a government. It's the leader. And so if an incumbent government wants to hold on and try with fewer seats, it's only the incumbent premier that can do that. If there's a new face to be chosen, then the Crown's representative, the lieutenant governor, will choose the person that he or she believes has the best shot, and that will be the leader of the party with the most seats. So that's kind of an aside. I just went down a bit of a rabbit hole there, and I apologize. So in terms of PEI, I just think that it would be so difficult for the Greens and the Liberals would have to come together and then just barely have enough seats, then have to find a speaker. And it's just so much easier for the Tories. Also, something that I learned in the New Brunswick experience, which I think would be very applicable in PEI, and I think you might have saw it a bit with the big hug between Peter Bevan Baker and Denny King that was going viral on social media a few days ago. It's really hard for the governing party to come from a majority and then try to put together a coalition just because of the trust factor. The nature of our system is that the opposition parties writ large wake up every day and go to bed every night having been airing grievances against the government all day. It's difficult for them who have common cause and having opposed the government for the last 4 years or however length the term was, to all of a sudden wake up the next day and feel more likely to side with the government than their comrades in arms from opposition. And that was something that really shone through to me in the Liberal Green talks here in New Brunswick, is that it was just so much water under the bridge from the previous 4 years. And there was no adversarial relationship between the opposition leaders because they don't have an adversarial relationship. So it is hard, I think, for the incumbent government, particularly in this day and age when things are a lot hotter than they have probably ever been. You've got the social media and you've got the phenomenon, and I've talked to a number of MLAs from different parties about this over the years, where there's just no friendships across party lines, which is quite different than it used to be when people kind of came to Fredericton and stayed here for several months and they all socialized and you know, there were relationships of a personal and trusting nature across the floor, and those don't really exist anymore. So I think for Wade McLaughlin, which is another complicating factor, he lost his seat. So who would the Greens even negotiate with? They don't have a leader yet. In New Brunswick, I think what was the big surprise to me, and in hindsight, it shouldn't have been a surprise, is that, you know, after having governed like majority governments tend to do, which is not necessarily playing all that nice with others, it's hard to show up and say, hey, let's play nice.
It is interesting to think about the roles that the leaders play. And I think probably, again, a much closer example in all ways, shapes, and forms is the BC comparison to New Brunswick, or I guess more aptly, the New Brunswick comparison to BC. Very, very similar situations. And again, I think we looked closely at BC to see what was going on there and how that was working. But I think, I would agree with you. It was a bit stark to recognize, and in New Brunswick, I think it was particularly stark to recognize the role that the four leaders elected play in how the entire government could move forward. That I found very interesting.
And how personal.
Oh, yeah. Well, it had, in a lot of cases, that's, again, one of the things that I found to be so interesting, is it really, honestly, at the surface, had nothing to do with political ideologies at all. It was 100% personal. And I think, to your point, like, how do you get over that? Like, you really can't. So I think, actually, another really interesting thing, what I was thinking about the rise in minority governments across the country, is the conversation that is often had around electoral reform and how some sort of proportional representation model would likely give rise to a more representative legislature, and so also typically a rise to more minority type governments, leading to more collaborative governing. So that, you know, that's kind of the line that folks will often draw. I'd love, and from my perspective, particularly here in New Brunswick, and even if you look at the Stephen Harper example, those minority governments did not have a brand of collaboration. So I'd love your perspective on that argument around minority governments being more collaborative, and thus, you know, electoral reform for a PR model being a good one because of that link. I know maybe I'm reaching and I'm getting a bit rambly here, but I'd like your opinion on if you think that that's a real line to be drawn on minority governments.
So first of all, I think there's like five more podcasts.
I know. I have so many questions there.
But there's a lot there. I'm going to grab a few pieces. So the Harper non-collaborative minority governments, which I think is quite comparable to the Higgs non-collaborative minority government that we're seeing here as well, is that there is kind of minority government by fear, and the fear being, hey, other parties, you don't have enough money, you don't have enough, you don't have your leader is too new or not ready, your slate of candidates isn't in place, we the government have a honeymoon period that's in effect, so if you don't prop us up, then we will wipe you out when the polls come. And the best example of that is John Diefenbaker. There's this hilarious story, and I don't even know if it's true. I actually should probably try to look that up at some point. But Diefenbaker won a really small minority government in the summer of 57. And in February of 58, so we're talking not long after, there was some big debate in the House, and there was some small scandal, and Lester Pearson, who had just become the Liberal leader, made some smart alecky comment allegedly about, well, you know, you guys aren't competent enough to govern, just cross over here and we'll cross over there and take care of it for you. And Diefenbaker just said, aha, here's my chance, and said, oh, well, if you guys think you're smart enough to govern, we'll let Canadians decide. Went to Rideau Hall and won the largest majority in history. So that kind of brinksmanship style of minority government is what I think we're more accustomed to here in Canada. I think there's a potential for the New Brunswick situation to be different because it is very different at a provincial level. I don't think there's another example that I can think of ever provincially where you had four parties as opposed to three. And there was that opportunity for, you know, two and two to kind of get together, which is sort of happening naturally here. There's no formal deal on the left opposition side of the house, and it's a big debate how formal the deal is on the right slash government side of the house. But there's just kind of a natural coming together because of ideological alignment. Whereas what we've usually had in Canada is kind of the big bad Liberals versus the big bad Tories, and then the third party, whomever that might be, is kind of the voice of conscience, if you will, in the legislature. Federally, we've had different instances because for a long time you had Social Credit and the NDP well represented, and certainly in the Joe Clark minority government. The Tories plus Social Credit were almost a majority. The Liberals plus the NDP were almost a majority. That's the most comparable situation I can ever think of to what we have in New Brunswick right now, where it's kind of two bigs and two littles. And stop me if I'm rambling for too long, but to get to your would PR help? I actually think that that is a good argument for PR. I think the reason why our minority governments don't work very well is because they're novel. And people don't know how to make them work. And so sometimes they work pretty good. Certainly, I think the Pearson minority governments in the 60s were very good because there was no formal deal, but it was, well, we'll put enough NDP into our budget and our throne speech and our legislative program to get their votes. And it was similar in Ontario in the 70s, it was the Bill Davis Conservative government, which had two back-to-back minorities, that put enough NDP into the mix that the NDP voted for them. And a lot of policies that would probably never have gotten done, got done. And I think they're good policies that have survived the test of time, things like, you know, Medicare. They can work, but they usually don't, in my experience. They usually either function like a majority government, which is unfortunate because you've not won a majority of seats, let alone votes, or they just break down real quickly. But if we had PR and these were normal and nobody ever expected to ever to be able to win a majority, natural alliances would form a lot friendlier. You see situations like in Sweden, the conservative and centrist parties sit in a coalition, whether they're on the government side or the opposition side, and they all have their own platforms, and really they just compete to see who can become relatively bigger to each other in the coalition to have the larger share of the portfolios and the larger share of their policies implemented. And those kinds of more collaborative things happen. Now, some people might argue that the Swedish example is a bad one because you've essentially got two parties. It's just the two parties that have a number of constituent sub-parties. So that's a bit of a rambly thing. But I do think PR had a lot of downside. It also has a lot of upside. And one of the upside is I do think we would get more collaborative government if we had PR.
Yeah, so maybe the question, or not even the question, but maybe, yeah, kind of some of the conclusion is if folks were more used to it, they would build better cross-collaborative relationships, and thus the smaller parties' voices may be heard more in the decision-making, et cetera, over time. And I think, again, yeah, just looking at the New Brunswick context, like it's exact opposite of more inclusive government. But I think back to what we chatted about a bit earlier, a lot of that does have to do with the lack of trust through really all parties.
The
sorry,
causation is correlation in this instance.
From, again, my perspective, I like the idea of hearing of more inclusive and collaborative governments and what that looks like, whether that's, again, getting more women elected, more young people, more folks with, you know, diverse lived experiences. Like I'm pro that, but again, I think getting those folks elected is a great step, but getting them into cabinet, for example, is a whole other conversation. And so, yeah, I think that I like your conclusion that if this was more normal, then perhaps those types of conversations would happen and we would start to see those relationships, which again, I think is a positive. So it'll be interesting though to see how the first past the post model kind of rolls out as far as creating the minority governments, because I don't think, again, after the PEI referendum, I don't think that there are many provinces that are really even still pushing hard on the electoral reform question. So we'll see how that unfolds in the next few years, I think.
Yeah, I think it's going to take a really disproportionate election result. So BC in 2001, it was 77-2. And that was not at all reflective of the popular vote. And I think the Greens were well into the double digits and got zero. And that kind of prompted kind of the big first push for PR in Canada. And the referendum, if it didn't have such a high threshold, would have passed. I think it had like 58% or so popular support, but the threshold was 60. And so they did a do-over, but by the time they did the do-over, an intervening election had occurred where the results were much more proportional, and then it only got 30-some% of the vote. So I think people need to have a real disproportionate election right in the back of their memory to cause people to want to vote for PR. And that's how it happened in New Zealand as well. It would have been a series of very disproportionate results, and it kind of created this momentum for a referendum which passed. So, I mean, we have those from time to time. We've had them certainly in New Brunswick quite a few times. So maybe one day in New Brunswick, the reaction to a real disproportionate result or in some other province will be a push for PR, and maybe it'll happen. I just hope they pick the right system, because some of them really are not fit for purpose, but I'll leave that for another podcast.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. Tune in for the next very wonky podcast when Jordan talks about all the different models of PR. Yeah, that would be a whole episode in itself, and maybe we'll get into it someday. But awesome. Well, yeah, I really just wanted to have a bit of a conversation around minority governments. I have been thinking about this type of episode since really the, you know, starting this idea 6 months ago, which kind of aligned well with the New Brunswick situation. So thanks again for sharing some of your experience. Any final thoughts, again, on your experience in New Brunswick, or more broadly on what to expect in Canada as we go forward down this thing we call democracy?
Well, I mean, the big question about the upcoming federal election is what's going to happen to the NDP and or the Greens and or the People's Party, because you can't have a minority government with two parties. So if all the smaller parties get squeezed out, then there'll be a majority government. So the question to me, the really interesting thing to watch in this election is it the Liberals and the Tories get 51% and 49% of the seats, or that they get 45% and 44% and there's 10 spread around. And obviously whether that's the case and how those other seats are spread around. I don't imagine the Greens or the NDP propping up a sheer government, but if Maxime Bernier catches fire somewhere, as he might. And if he does, then we might see something very similar to what we saw in New Brunswick, with a big right of center party, a big left of center party, and a small left party and a small right party, which is really kind of very interesting. And that is a unique makeup, or near unique makeup, for minority governments in Canada.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good thing for us to tune into. We'll have to keep our eye on how that unfolds. And perhaps, again, we'll get to see New Brunswick leading the charge on innovative governments. I don't know, have we ever led the charge on innovative governments?
We are often a harbinger for what will happen nationally. Mm-hmm. Certainly in 91, the election of the core party foreshadowed the election of reform in 93 federally, for example. You never know.
You never know. I think that's a great way to end the episode.
As always, thank you again for tuning in. please subscribe to the podcast. And if you love this episode, leave us a review. You can also follow along on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Monk. See you next week.